We are approaching Earth Day in an age of cataclysmic predictions for our planet. Like the ones you heard me read earlier. Odd weather events, devastating storms, and a forecast that says if we do nothing, things are likely to get a whole lot worse. And yet, I wonder, and I notice, and I question how much of this awareness filters into our day-to-day. How much do we hear about it or talk about it? When temperatures hit the 70s in December a couple of years ago, I couldn't help but notice the number of newspaper articles celebrating the joy of a summer-like day in December, but not saying anything about global warming or minimizing the possible connection. I don't know about you, but raising the topic in my social circles is rarely a big hit. I've noticed more than once people smile faintly and look down or away, or they'll change the topic quickly, or I will. I was given a cartoon years ago, I don't remember by whom. In it, you see an erudite-looking gentleman with a notebook sitting in a chair, psychology diploma hanging on the wall behind him. And on the couch lying next to him is a large elephant on his back, legs dangling in the air. The expression of the elephant is deeply sad as he laments. Sometimes, even if I stand in the middle of the room, no one acknowledges me. We have an elephant in the middle of the room, and we do not necessarily want to acknowledge it. And you've probably noticed sounding the alarm louder isn't exactly helping. It almost seems like the louder it gets, the more frightening things we hear about that poor neglected elephant, the more it gets ignored. I feel it. Last year, in anticipation of Earth Day, I skimmed books, watched movies, read articles, watched clip after video clip. I started doing that last month, too, and then I stopped. It's almost like the more I read how bad it's going to be, the less I was absorbing. The more terrifying the predictions, the more some part of me wants to just label them catastrophic thinking or throw them into the category of fantasy movies that I can then tune out. Or I hear about schemes like putting a giant space umbrella in the sky or liquefying carbon dioxide, and I think to myself, oh good, they're on it. Someone will fix this. I calm myself with thoughts that everything's going to be okay. I find ways to keep the troubling predictions at bay. Denial is a natural phenomenon, an innate reaction to overwhelming circumstances, an evolutionary safety switch that protects organisms like us from circuit overload. Blinders that enable us to continue functioning under even extreme stress. It is an understandable evolutionary adaptation. And when the news is really tough or requires more of us than we think we can handle, I suspect that's where we all start. We minimize it, we block it out, we focus on what's right in front of us so we can just keep going. Denial. We know about denial, of course. We see how this works in every area of life. I had a highly tuned off switch as a kid for things like room cleaning, dishwashing, and homework doing. The louder the admonitions got, the more excuses I found to stay in my bedroom or the bathroom or some other room that was not where I was supposed to be. Oh, look, here's a book I need to rifle through right now. Is that my mom calling? I think I should wash my hands again. Ooh, look at this soap, it's so pretty. Oh, did I miss doing the dishes again? I don't know where the time went. As adults, the repercussions of shutting our eyes or ears can be more significant than an annoyed parent or an unwashed dish or two. We may deny we have problems with money and we keep spending, or we deny how upset we are by someone's anger and we don't set boundaries, or maybe we deny an illness so we don't have to take the medicine, or we deny difficulties in our closest relationships so we don't have to work on them or on us. The bigger the issue, the more it calls for change in us. And if we feel guilty for what we haven't yet been able to do, the more likely any of us is to want to shut it out. It can become an escalating dynamic. The worse things look, the thicker the barriers we build against it, the worse things get. And the climate crisis? Wow. Talk about a call to change. And talk about denial. Even leaving aside those actively promoting the idea that climate change doesn't exist or isn't caused by us, I have to look at my own innocent, hopeful reliance that someone will come up with some technical fix. Though I am grateful to those who are trying, some of the ideas leave me wondering. We know there is an interdependent web. We know that when we tinker with one element of a system, other elements can respond in unpredictable ways. When scientists came up with DDT, there were unexpected repercussions to the health of the rest of the ecosystem. And although a giant space umbrella sounds cool and may block the sun and help stop global warming, what other effects will that have? And we kind of recognize this anyway. We kind of know the difference between a Band-Aid and real healing. We know that ultimately, if we don't address the root of a problem, it will resurface again in some other form. And we are consistently exceeding the biocapacity of our Earth. And this is a problem even space umbrellas cannot solve. Naomi Klein puts it this way. What the climate needs to avoid collapse is a contraction in humanity's use of resources. What our economic model demands to avoid collapse is unfettered expansion. Only one of these sets of rules can be changed, and it's not the laws of nature. And as we heard from her earlier, we need an entirely new way of sharing this planet. We need to evolve. In this month of emergence, I've been thinking about what that evolutionary process of emergence looks like. And in this time of destruction and deconstruction, fires, floods, as well as political upheavals, I've been thinking about how destruction, dissolution, and emergence sometimes go hand in hand. And I've been thinking about transformation and what that takes for societies, for individuals, what it really takes to change. In 12-step groups, there is a concept called the gift of desperation. It's what happens when the consequences of unhealthy actions become so destructive as to become undeniable. An alcoholic totals the car, a drug addict loses her job, a gambler's spouse walks out on them. Circumstances become desperate, which feels awful. But the person drops their denial, which is a gift. Finally, resistance dissipates and change becomes possible. The person is willing to open their eyes to a full picture and take actions that address the root of the problem. Healing becomes possible. Peace and serenity become possible. something new can finally emerge. I suspect, though, that when desperation is received as a gift, it does not operate alone. There is another ingredient, something deeper, something lasting, something fundamental that is also in the mix. Some would call that connection or grace. Some might call it God. Some call it love. I am convinced that this force is there, not just in the beautiful and lovely, but right there in the desperation, in loss, in grief, in the hardest places, growing our capacity to drop denial and hold it all. I struggle with denial and numbness around climate change. I don't want to look at it. I don't know how to process it. I feel guilty about what I haven't yet done. I resist thinking about it, but I know I need to. I find myself drawn to stories that embody this wider truth of not only the desperation we must face, but also this wider, undefinable love that is somewhere in and through it all and helps us hold it all. Sometimes life offers the unexpected emerges as a surprise. My next sentence is that I've been finding myself drawn to the story of Tim DeChristopher. So I will say I was surprised when I saw Tim DeChristopher walking into the sanctuary right before we began. So Tim, I hope you'll correct me if I have anything wrong. He's been here at our church a couple of times. He preached for us in March, and many of you saw the film Bitter 70 shown here in February. The film is all about a bold action that Tim took to preserve the gorgeous Red Rock Wilderness of Utah. He disrupted an illegal oil and gas auction, preventing big oil from defacing the land for development and thereby preventing yet more oil from being burned. The film journals the story of his activism, his passion for the planet, and his willingness to go to jail to lift up the urgency of our situation, all of which makes him kind of a climate justice hero in my book. And the question I've been holding in my struggle is, how did he do it? How did he find the willingness to jump in and the courage to continue? How did he not just go through it, but lead through it, inspire others through it, somehow keeping up his hope, his faith, and his love? How did he emerge from the helplessness and denial that is all around and inside us? How does anyone do that? I was struck in the film by Tim's love for the land, for other people. As the film shows shot after shot of him backpacking in the canyonlands in Utah, you get a palpable sense of his passion for these places. And you get an inkling of what fuels his passion for environmental justice. And again in that same film, Tim talked about the importance of his connection with others, the support of his community, his commitment to climate justice, not just for the sake of the earth, but for all the people who live here. So on the one hand, you have this person, Tim, who is connected to love of the land, love of others. But I was also struck by his description of his state of mind, which was troubled. More than troubled, bereft, you could say. In one scene, he describes listening to a Nobel Prize-winning scientist explain that it's too late to avoid all the worst consequences of climate change. And to have a Nobel Peace Prize winner say that it was too late to protect my own future, he says, it shook me to the core. I went outside the hotel and cried. I mourned for my own future. I mourned for the future of all of us. But then also, he said later, it woke me up. It sank in, finally, how serious it was. A turning point. Setting up the moment when Tim takes his leap, wades into the waters of civil disobedience, and disrupts that oil and gas auction, basically breaking the law. I had all these visions of my future and the catastrophic effects of climate change, he says, looking back at his thoughts in that moment. But if I take this action, there's a decent chance I could go to prison. Could I live with that? And I thought, well, yeah. And then he continues, but knowing I had a chance to do something about it, but didn't because I was afraid of the consequences, I thought, no, I couldn't live with that. So he says, I finally took that step and I jumped all the way in and started winning parcels, preventing that land from being sold to oil companies. When I did that, he said, my head was totally clear. I felt this real feeling of calm come over me, and that conflict I was dealing with was gone. What does it take to change? To break through numbness, apathy, or denial? To become willing to open our eyes to even that which deeply troubles us, allowing it to change us, making way for courage and a deeper peace to emerge on the other side. How do we connect with or create the kind of sustaining love that flows through and guides and steadies us? Tim was ultimately sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. At his sentencing hearing, he says of his civil disobedience, "This is what love looks like, and it will only grow." And whether or not we are called to become climate justice warriors in that particular way, there are many ways to love our earth and each other in this time. We start from where we are, and we grow. One act of love at a time. From biking to church to use the new bike racks that are going to be installed to divesting from fossil fuels. From taking action to ensure more green energy in the state to using and washing the cloth napkins that Green Sanctuary has made available for our events. From working to elect candidates who are committed to the earth, to reaching out to newcomers, to each other, building a community of support and care right here. Every time we make a choice to love the earth and each other with our actions, we grow in our capacity to hold it all. When Tim came and preached here a few weeks ago, his friend and fellow activist, Brian Cahill, sang a song called Praise Be the Ragtime Band, and it has been playing in my mind ever since. When Tim introduced it, he said something like this: we can't fully hold the unthinkable in our minds. The situation with our climate is full of paradox and complexity that we don't know what to do with. But when we allow grief for what we may lose and gratitude for what we love to work together, We can hold in our hearts what we can't really understand with our minds. So I'd like to share that song with you again this morning, an invitation into grief and gratitude, an invitation into trouble, and the larger love that holds it and us all.